for the fun part. I have absolutely no idea if our speaker is here, so I will introduce our speaker and hope to hell that somebody comes up here. Now I will turn this portion of the meeting over to our speaker, Bob E.
Oh, God, the temptation to stay in the chair for about 5 minutes to test his program a little bit. Hi, I'm Bob Earl. I am a drug addict and an alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here to help you celebrate your birthdays. As August is also my birthday month. About 3 more days here. And thank you very much, but it's 3 more days. I'm a person that believes in jinxes. You know, I never take a cake before the birthday. It's like, yeah, let's just, when it comes around, it comes around. To the contingency from the turn off, welcome. Glad you're here. A little recognition never hurts anybody. To the rest of you. For those of you who are drug addicts and alcoholics like myself, welcome. The rest of them are drug addicts. They don't know it. We must be patient. They have yet to read a doctor's opinion in the beginning of the book. Well, I heard a great line in Canada here a couple of weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I've fallen in love with it. From an Al-Anon speaker, and she said that she was told that her responsibility was to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. So I'm here to disturb the comfortable. And if you get nothing more out of this whole meeting when you leave and I leave, then you're pissed off. I have accomplished what I wanted to do. I meet people now in AA or new coming in now that are fascinating. There's a new breed coming in. And, there are a lot of them out there who were, although granted whacked out totally behind heroin, cocaine, or what, you know, alcohol or whatever, they were still very much into metaphysical, spiritual matters and health. So they were trying as good as they could to take care of the body and the system. So although they were running 70 miles a week, meditating 4 hours a day, and involved in a lot of other activities like this, and the alcohol and the drugs were killing them, well, they come in here, see, and they say, oh, yeah, okay, God, I got it, great. This is where you get rid of the alcohol and drugs. But they look at the rest of us and say, what the hell are you doing? I mean, you got rid of the big problem. Why are you still killing yourself? You know, what is, we have a problem in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the problem seems to be, in my opinion, everything I say is my own opinion gathered in the last 22 years of being clean and sober. My opinion is the problem that we seem to have in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we opt for the negative. You know, it's like we're so geared to opting for the negative, the negative gets the support. And anytime anybody moves out into a positive, you know, way of their life, of taking care of themselves or their family or their lives, it's like they're looked upon with, you know, distrust. And I'm always amazed when people come up to me and they haven't seen me in a few years, you know, and they sit down and say, oh, it's really good to see you, and you've really changed. And I always sit there and think, isn't that what we're supposed to do? I mean, shouldn't people always be surprised when they see us after 4 or 5 years? Shouldn't they be stunned when they hear the words coming out of our mouths that they're totally different? Shouldn't they be really surprised because we've changed? And what I've started to see a lot of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's been existing forever, but I see it now, is that we go along in sobriety, and suddenly we reach a spot and we get stuck, dead. It's like we just hit a wall and stop. And we hit this wall and we stay there. And it's like there's a lot of long, uncomfortable sobriety. You know? And it's almost like you reach a point in your sobriety where we all become jugglers. And we have this little group of balls, you know, and we're just trying to keep them in the air. And all we want to do is just keep this little group, and we don't want anybody taking one of the balls out, making it easier for us. And we don't want anybody adding a ball. You know. And making it harder for us. So what we really want to do is we want to try and keep life the same. We want to keep status quo. It's like, okay, the boss didn't yell at me today. Good day. Wife didn't yell at me. Things are going well financially. And if I can just remember everything I did today, make a list, and do this forever, I'll be okay. And then we proceed to try and make what worked today work 2 years from now. And it won't work. That doesn't stop us. Don't think for a minute that it's not working will stop us. It won't, because the alternative is change. The alternative is to change. The alternative is to take a risk. And it just seems to be something that we don't do well around here. And there's a lot of opinions. There's a lot of reasons as to why. There's been 3 studies done lately, one that I'm aware of and the results of, and a couple are still in the process. And they are on relapse, why the alcoholic goes out and drinks again after a few years of sobriety. All these studies being done in different parts of the country are coming to the same conclusion. It is how the sober alcoholic takes care of himself. That they keep themselves in an emotional state of unbalance by diet, smoking, coffee, etc., etc. And if you stay in this emotional state of unbalance long enough, and the pain gets great enough, you're going to go back out and drink again. I always love watching birthdays at meetings. You know, where are all the people that were here 20 years ago? Where were all the people that were here 15 years ago? Where the hell are they? Why aren't they up here tonight saying, hey, right on. You know, it's great. I'm having a good time. Sobriety's moving. You know, they're not here. You know, they decided not to change. Let me get into this the way I know how to get into it. The easiest way I can get into all this is, because it really was one of the things that caught my attention. Here a couple of years ago, I guess it's a couple of years now, I've lost track, doesn't matter. A friend of mine called me, a non-alcoholic friend, not on the program, said, I have some house guests who would like to go to an AA meeting, 4 guys. So I said, great. I'll take them. So I want you to meet them. They'll be very interesting people. So it'll be an experience for you to meet these people. I always want, you know, it's always tells you that, you gotta go meet them, right? See how the hell they are. You know, are they swinging through the living room by vines or, you know, what? I want to know. Yeah, I want to see them. So I go, and what I'm confronted with, ironically enough, is 2 psychiatrists from the state of New York. Young guys, very bright. Both are have doctorate degrees in more than a single specialty of psychiatric behavior, for whatever that's worth to you. Let me tell you, their wheels were turning, and they were fast. The other 2 guys were fascinating. The other 2 guys were of great interest to me, of immense interest to me. They're travelers. And they, looking in their eyes was in and of itself an experience, because I was confronted with 2 men who have never in their life tasted a drink of alcohol, smoked a narcotic, or used a narcotic of any kind. They have never eaten a piece of meat of any kind, whether it be beef, chicken, fish. They've never eaten it. They don't know what it tastes like. They have no idea what it tastes like. They have never eaten sugar in their lives. They have no idea what sugar tastes like, what coffee tastes like, what diet colas take like. They don't know what any of that stuff tastes like. They've never had any. And both of these guys were in their 40s, right? So this wasn't some fad they started last week, okay? They were raised this way as children. And they've grown up this way. And they were taught, they somehow took this saying out of the Bible and they took it literally. I can't understand why. They believe that, yes, God put it all here for us to enjoy. So they were busy enjoying it. They had spent the last 30 years of their life just traveling. They have no income. They just travel. They provide help where help is needed, and they seem to always get help where help is, you know, where they need it. And they are perfectly comfortable with that method of operation. They don't care. So I bring these four diverse types to three Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because they've never been to them and they want to see what they're like and what goes on. A discussion meeting, a participation meeting, and a speaker meeting. We get done. And I won't bother you with what the psychiatrist said. They were greatly impressed. They were very impressed. They were impressed with the program. They were in awe of the program. They thought it was incredible. They thought these tools applied would work wonders psychologically in anybody's life. Applied. Remember the secret words of that. These tools applied, not just, you know, lacquered and stuck on the wall. Okay? The travelers were equally impressed. Now, but there's one thing, they didn't agree on why we were sober. Okay? Needless to say, they were not. You would almost wonder what was wrong if they did. The psychiatrist, of course, knew why we were sober. Due to the tremendous psychiatric potential of the, you know, psychological cleansing of the blood. Okay, I can't even remember how they worded it. Took them a lot of words to say why it works. The travelers had it much simpler. They knew that we were clean and sober for one reason, by grace. Wasn't a big fucking deal of them. We were sober because God wanted us sober. No, you know. Now, here comes the kicker, guys. This is where I want to start making the comfortable uncomfortable. Disturb you. With all the sincerity two men like this are capable of, they looked at me. All four agreed on this one thing, but it was the travelers who really caught my attention. They said, these people have been inflicted with a terminal disease. They have had a disease which will take their life. It will kill them. They have come to this organization, Alcoholics Anonymous, spiritually devised program, and by grace they have had this removed from them. They have had the terminal disease removed from them. They are free from it. And yet, and they were awed, they were stunned, they couldn't believe it. They said, but yet they continue to sit in those rooms and destroy themselves. They smoke cigarettes by the carton. They drink coffee by the barrel. They eat sugar by the pound. Nobody sleeps. Nobody gets enough sleep. Everybody runs on a high level of anxiety, and nobody breathes. They couldn't understand it. One of them caught hell for breathing in the AA meeting. You know, he was just doing a little deep breathing, sitting quietly in his chair during the meeting. Some, you know, light, happy member of AA got upset because the guy was breathing. You know. Knock off the breathing. We don't breathe here. If you breathe, you feel things, and, you know, we don't feel things here. We prefer to deal in intellectual concepts of emotional pain. Well, I had no argument. There's no argument. You can't say a word to them. They're absolutely right. Their perception of the program is perfect. What they see is correct. It's right down the line. We come here, we're set free from a disease that's killing us, and we continue to wipe ourselves out. And we do it, and we justify it, and we rationalize it. We do it to the point where it's like, you know, you get in the AA meetings, and the non-smoker section, you know, you like put them like little worms over in your glass, you know? Everybody has to walk by the non-smoker section while they're busy killing themselves and make jokes. I always love that. You know, we're into that. You know, looking good while we take our, you know, kill ourselves. You know.
Hey, sucker, don't smoke, huh?
Sure glad you gave up the cigarettes. We sit around a lot, you know, alone. Most of the people I know in sobriety and AA. We want, you know, all we want is somebody to come love us. That's all. Just somebody please love me. That's all. Please, please love me. I got a great suggestion. Why don't you start loving you? You know? I hear all the time in AA, you know, I keep hearing this thing, how a newcomer is the most important person in the room. I hear it over and over again. You know, I've never read it anywhere, but I hear it a lot. And I believe that the newcomer, if we choose to view AA like a furnace that needs coals to keep it going, then the newcomer is the most important person in the room. If you don't choose to view AA like a furnace that needs coals to keep it going, then the single most important person in this room sits in your chair. There's nobody more important. Nobody. Because if we don't take care of ourselves, there's not going to be anybody running up a newcomer anyway. So this is a moot point. You know, there will be no organization someday. So it's time we start. Why not? Well, there's a lot of opinions. Why not? Would one of you guys make up your fucking mind and speak? I just bring them, you know. I just. Best I can do is get the four up in here, and then they're on their own. Huh? Well, I was at a men's retreat in Portland here a couple months ago, and there was 40 of us, and of the 40 of us, 36 had an alcoholic parent. What I'm convinced of, and there's a lot of other people convinced of, it's not just me, seems to be two things go on here for a lot of us. I'm just talking about me, so don't, you know, get yourself crazy with any of this. Or, I mean, go ahead if you want. And any feeling that I can, you can get going, I'd be supportive of, you know. Well, we have a thing, I don't know about up here, but down south in AA, you know, there's a thing that gets me absolutely crazy. Somebody will get to a podium and just express a feeling about something, and half the group will go, oh. And I get whippo when I hear that one. I go right straight out to the roof like a skyrocket, because that's such bullshit I can't even believe that we're doing it in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know. I mean, that's insanity, guys. The one thing that we're supposed to do here is get in touch with our feelings, to find out what we feel. And the minute somebody gets up and expresses a feeling, or be to feel bad for expressing the feeling, where are we coming from when we do that stuff? You know. I mean, we're not really bad guys. We're just afraid of our own feelings. That's all I understand. I ran for mine successfully for 17 years, clean and sober. I'm here, you know, if you wonder what the hell I'm here to talk about, if you're 19 years old, man, and a year sober, I'm here to talk to you because I'd like to see you cut 17 years of bullshit out of your life, you know. Right. But you got to look around. At some point, you're going to start to get concerned, you know? And the minute you're going to look around, you're going to start to get concerned is the minute the feelings start coming up. The minute you start to hit feelings. For most of us, it seems to be around I don't know anymore today, but back when, it seemed most of us, it was around 2 or 3 years, feelings started to come up. And at that point, we immediately knew that we were crazier now than we had ever been drinking or using. 3 years sober, if nailed by a shrink, I'd be gone, you know. I mean, they would know that there was no hope I could function in a world, you know, contained anything near rational human beings, because I was looking at it strangely. And it's like, so rather than let these feelings come up, because I didn't know how to live with them, I just stuffed them back down again. In AA, it's easy to do. You can get a lot of support for all the negative behavior you want to do around. I mean, that's always been one of my biggest bitches about Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you can get more support for failure here than you can success. And that's, well, you know, I mean, I'm here to disturb the comfortable, but think about it for a minute. Think about your own little group. You know, your own little home group, right? That stalwart little group you go to. Let's say that one particular member of that group, you know, just a quiet little guy, never has a lot to say, but he shows up every week. One week he bops into your little, you know, meeting, and he's just grinning ear to ear and bouncing around. He can't stand still. He's so goddamn happy. He sits down in his little chair and he can't wait to talk, and finally it's his turn. And then he goes, ready to bust. And he says, you know what, man, today I went out, I signed a contract for a brand new goddamn job, and they're going to give me $250,000 just for signing the fucking paper. You got that? $250,000 just for signing the paper. I'm going to make another $750,000 a year, and they're going to give me a Rolls Royce to drive. I can't stand it. Let's see who takes him the coffee after the meeting. That doesn't want something from him. But conversely, let him come back in 6 months. Quiet, sad, depressed. Sit at the table and say, Jesus, I lost it all. After the meeting, he will be look like a goddamn white man, man surrounded by Indians. All, did you lose everything? Let's go to coffee and talk about it. The car too, huh? You lost that big car too, right? Well, who the hell wants to be successful if this is what you're going to get? I mean, why strive to be successful if the very people that you need for your life's blood, if this group that you go, if this organization you came to that gave you your life, is going to wipe your ass out and let you make a buck? You know, it's easier to stay in this little safe place where everybody likes you and approves of what you're doing. Well, how come? God, we're not bad guys. Why would we do that to somebody? I mean, we're not bad people here. We're not evil people here. Why in the world would we treat people like that? Because we think they got ours. We think the contract he signed was the one we were supposed to have. And we're never going to get ours. That son of a bitch got it, right? I'm supposed to be happy? Oh, hey, I can work a spiritual program to a point, you know what? But well, the only reason I feel that way and the only reason I think that way is because I don't really believe down deep inside of me I'm ever going to get mine anyway. See? Because I don't think I deserve mine. Because basically, although I'm a clean and sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and have worked my ass off and written inventories and gone to meetings and gone to institutions and talked to people and hauled newcomers and done it all, made coffee, moved chairs, although I've done all of that the best I can and I'm doing really well in my career, I still think of myself like basically a turd. And I can't enjoy my success because I know it's going to be taken away because I don't deserve it in the first place. You know, so why would I feel this way? What the hell's wrong with me? How can you go through 17 years of sobriety? How can you do the very best job you know how to do? How can you come from a skinny, dying, hopeless drug addict, drug off of rooftops to your first meeting, because that's where you live, to a place of success and recognition in AA and recognition in your profession, and yet you still think it's going to be taken away? You still have voices that say, when they find out. You're finished, sucker. When they find, never says what they're going to find out. It just says when they find out, you know. When they find out, you're finished. Well, that's one of the four personalities, that fun voice that's always there to support you whenever you're going to take on any new challenge, you know.
Gee, I think I'll go to school and become a doctor. Don't be fucking silly, you idiot.
Nobody else will say that to you, but you will, you know. Nobody else cares enough to take the time to talk you out of being a doctor but you. And you'll spend weeks talking yourself out of it. Nobody else cares that much, you know. Nobody else will take that much time. As bad as they hate you, they wouldn't take weeks to talk you out of being a doctor. You know. Or anything else. I love the guy. Can't ever remember who it is. He went to his sponsor and said, God, you know, I really want to be a lawyer. I really, really want to be a lawyer, and I really want to go to law school. You know, but by the time I graduate from law school, I'll be 44 years old. Sponsor looks at him with a very blank expression and says, well, how old will you be then if you don't graduate? But we're conditioned to that. We're conditioned to that. We're conditioned to not going for what down here inside of us, this secret little part says, geez, I'd really like to go paint. Or, I'm tired of being a goddamn accountant and doing people's books. I'd like to go work on boat engines down in the harbor. I can't do that. You know, I'm clumsy with wrenches and I'll never be anything. I better do what my dad did. I better just keep doing books. We'll get into the, I don't have enough time to get into the ramifications of that one. I don't even want to touch it if you're doing what your dad did. Not me. I don't want to disturb you that much. I just want to make you a little uncomfortable. I don't want to, you know, send you through the windows over here either. Oh, why can't we do any of these things? What the hell is the matter? You know, what is the problem? Why can't we do any of these things? Well, I know why I couldn't. Once I took care of, quote, for all intents and purposes, once I had taken care of the drug and alcohol problem, once I was no longer putting narcotics and alcohol in my body, once I was no longer thinking about narcotics and alcohol all day long, once that was not the first thing that came to my mind when a crisis came up, once I had passed that magic spot where it was something I used to do and not something I do now and not something I would consider doing now, I'm now confronted with another great, big, huge problem. Okay? I have just finished years of working a program. And the focus of this program is exactly what it should be. I don't know if anything works better for the alcoholic and the drug addict and AA. I don't know anywhere, everywhere I've been. I've never seen anything that works like AA. It does something that's essential for us. We come in here and we have been victims of the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction, and we've got some strange and bizarre behavior behind us. Along with the strange and bizarre behavior we have behind us, we've got even stranger and bizarre thinking behind us. And so we need to look at this life we have lived, and these 12 steps, we begin to apply them, and they set us free from the drug addiction and alcoholism. It helps us get rid of the guilt of what we are. It helps me get rid of the guilt of my disease. But once I have gotten rid of the guilt of my disease, now I'm still going out there, going through life, and I'm coming home at night, and I'm trying to be a good AA, and I'm working the program, you know? And I'll come home at night, and I'm going to take my daily inventory, and I'll sit down by the edge of the bed, you know, and I'll think, okay, who did I harm today? You know, who did I speak crossly to, or who did I brush off, or who did I this to? And I think, okay, I'll do amends, or I will learn amends, and who did I do this to? And yeah, okay, there must be something wrong with me. You know, okay, I'll fix that. I'll work on that. There's still something wrong with me. I'm now conditioned to think that there's something wrong with me. I'm always looking at me. I never ask myself at the end of the day, who was abrupt with me? brushed me aside? Who hurt my feelings? You know, who made me feel bad? Well, I can't ask that because I'm here to deal with my problem, which is alcoholism, and find out what I did wrong. Well, I believe, based on my experience, there comes a point for many of us when we got to turn the focus around. And the reason we do is we're going to stay stuck until we do. Because it's like, for me it's plain and simple. I learn to feel about myself the way I feel about myself because I was raised by two people who never should have had a child. Ever. If there had been a panel that quizzed you, they would not have passed. They would have had to get a used model down the street or something. They would have never been allowed a new model, okay? I was raised in a typical household. I was raised with an alcoholic father and the co-alcoholic, the partner in crime, right? Who stands quietly by in her apron in the goddamn kitchen and smiles sweetly while the fucking family's being destroyed around her ears. But it's okay. We'll get better one of these days. Meanwhile, human lives are, you know, being shattered. Well, I never ever looked at that. I never knew it was okay to look at that. I never could remember it. I'm one of these people whose all my inventories began at 15 years of age. I can never remember back past 15 years of age. And I took my inventories with five different sponsors, none of whom could remember back past 15 years of age, right? So we all agreed that's when your inventory starts, at 15, you know. I never thought that you had to remember back there, that any of that stuff back there was important. I used to say, it's like this, guys. You come into Alcoholics Anonymous and there's a lot of intellectual phrases, cliches, that just bounce off these walls, and they're great, and they're really true, and they're intellectually sound. But until you're emotionally ready for them, you're dead. You're dead. And one of them that I got hit with when I first came in, I was sitting down, I was talking to the sponsors, all of whom were maniacs, right? And I said something about my old man. I said, oh, son of a bitch, you know, God damn, man, every time I wanted to do anything, he was just drunk, you know? Nothing. We never talked, nothing. He was just drunk. And this sponsor would have heard this from somebody else, right? Looked at me and said, hey, listen. And he was just talking from his head. He meant well. You gotta forgive your father and your mother. They did the best job they could with the tools that they had. Oh, okay, great. Yeah, makes sense. That makes sense, right? It's intellectually, it makes sense. Yeah, sure, okay, great. They did the best job they could with the tools they had. Hey, I'll buy that. That's fine. Okay. Now Christmas comes. Okay? So you go for holidays with the family. Yeah. Drop in, you know, mom there, the rest of the family, the uncles, all of whom are alcoholics are there. You know? all the aunts who are their enablers, they're there, you know, the whole gang's there, right? And you sit down, you got your little present, you brought your little present, you're about a year sober, 2 years sober, you're doing the best you can, you don't know how to do it any better, you're there, you're with the family, it's Christmas. Everybody's happy, smiling, you know the smiles, right? They've had the smiles on for 50 years. You know? Tommy says, sprayed on a guy. You know? So you're sitting there with a family, you've been there about 5 minutes, and you feel like you've been there 5 hours, and you're starting to get acid indigestion, and your stomach is upset, you're the only one in the room that's hot, and you can feel your throat starting to close, because you can't talk, because you're starting to want to say a few things you don't even know what they are, but you know it's going to ruin the gathering. And the biggest wish you have is for a flamethrower. Right? You'd like to just torch the whole goddamn family. And leave. But the minute you have that thought, you're so trained, you go, oh, God, what's wrong with me? You know? There must be something wrong with me. How can I think these thoughts? These two poor people did the best they could. What's the matter with me? You know? Jesus, I'm working the worst goddamn program in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I've got to go change that. So you spend a whole year trying to change that and come back next Christmas. Nothing changes. You're there 15 minutes and you want to die. We don't really want to die. You've gotten better than that. You want them to die. AA has at least stopped you from wanting to take your life. They're on thin goddamn ice, you know, but they're like, But again, the minute you think that, you say, Jesus, what's wrong with me? You know, why do I think these things? Why am I so goddamn screwed up, you know? No wonder the board of criminal psychiatry kept talking with me, you know, about my behavior. Yeah. What is wrong with me? Nothing. There's nothing wrong with you. You're just fine. If you're like I am, you were raised in a household with behavior that is punishable by law. You were raised with parents who should have been put in goddamn jail for the way they treated you. And yet we walk around and act like that doesn't matter. No, it's okay. Yeah, sure. So, you know, yeah, I know my mom spent a week. I have a good friend. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, you know, what happened to the children? And I know we're all parents too, right, guys? So this is a two-way ball here. I said I'm here to disturb the comfortable. But first you got to clean up one act before you can clean up the other act, you know. And it's like, I know I have a good, one of my friends in his family, it's like his mother spent 2 weeks walking around the house saying, the only problem I have is you and your father. If it wasn't for you and your father, and you're the result of a failed abortion attempt, you know, if it wasn't for you and your father, I would be okay. At the end of 2 weeks' time, she took her life using the gas stove with the child in the apartment. Okay? I have another friend, his mother used to come in drunk in the middle of the night, pour garbage in his crib and tell him that's what he was. Garbage. And a pain in the ass. I know people have been beaten half to death. Young girls who were molested sexually by their parents, drunk. And the story's going on. These halls are filled with it, guys. We're filled with this. And yet we walk around here as though somehow, magically, this stuff is supposed to disappear from us. That somehow, magically, just because we've worked these 12 steps, we're supposed to go on and function without it having any effect on us. I got a handy piece of information for you. I hope it works that way for you. But it sure as hell didn't work that way for me, because as long as I was caught up in thinking they were right and I was wrong, I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't go anywhere, because I still felt I deserved it. I still felt there was something wrong with me, you know, and I was raised in the kind of household, the subtle kind of stuff, you know, like, I have really high arches, and I had to wear special shoes when I was a child, and they were expensive. All right, when you got an alcoholic father, everything is expensive. That isn't consumable. Okay, so I can remember standing in the hallway telling my mother about my tears in my eyes streaming down my face that my shoes hurt because they were too small. I can remember my mother, the peacekeeper, right? Oh, God. You know, we don't want your dad to hear. And your dad will get angry. Can't make dad angry. We'll just wear shoes that don't fit. Till now, I have a right foot that's practically a club foot that rolls over, you know, and lays on its side. That's what you get. Well, if that's the kind of treatment that you've had on your child, you don't have a hell of a lot of self-esteem as an adult. Okay? And my opinion is, you can write these steps 175,000 goddamn times, You can write 125,000 goddamn inventories, and until you change the focus, nothing's going to change. You're going to reach a point in your sobriety, and I know hundreds of us who have, where you're stuck, and you can't figure out what's wrong. You don't know why you can't go further. You can't make yourself take care of yourself. You can't make yourself try and get a better job. You can't make yourself try and improve your education. You can't make yourself do anything. All you do is come up with constant reasons and excuses as to why you can't. Yeah, I can't do it. You know? Well, no, of course you can't do it, because you were taught you can't do it. You were taught to be quiet. You were taught what you thought and what you felt didn't matter. It wasn't important. You know, you learn early on as a child in an alcoholic household to stuff something. Guess what it is? It's your feelings. You learn early on, man, do not create any disturbance. Don't be too happy. You'll get it in the ass for being happy just as quick as you will for being too... There's a standard line. Walk in the house. How many of you walk in the house crying? From outdoors, right? Tears in your eyes. Somebody hurt your feelings, maybe. Maybe your toy broke. You know, some very real thing in the life of a child. And there's a standard line you got. I'll give you something to cry about. While not being total mental misfits, you know, we say, well, I understand this one. Yeah. I've worked this one out. I know something I'll do no more in this house. Let's cry, you know. And one time he can be out playing, happy, just giggling, get a laughing fit going for no reason. You think that's funny? I'll show you something funny. Say, okay, I don't need any more of that shit either, you know. So you start to live in this little box. You know, you live in a very restricted, very confined area of emotions. You begin to deny your own feelings. You begin to deny the fact you'd like to kill them both. You know, you begin to deny the fact that you're happy, that you're sad, that you're scared, that you're anything. You know, let's talk about emotions and feelings. It's interesting. Let's talk about fear. They say that small children, when born, have two fears upon birth. Falling and loud noises. If you're afraid of anything other than falling or a loud noise while you sit here tonight, guess where you learned it? Guess where you got it? You know? And so, this is a tough subject, you know, because it gets so much going in so many people, because I have to look at what was done to me and then I got to look at what I did, you know. And it's like, there's at a point, it's like, if my, what worked for, what worked for me is, 17 years clean and sober, I had to go into therapy. Somebody suggested it to me, it was the best goddamn suggestion anybody ever made to me in 17 years of sobriety. Because I was going to die. I was 17 years sober and I was going to die. Recognized authority. I was going to die. Because I still had no self-esteem, I still had no self-worth, I still had all these feelings of inadequacy, I still couldn't have a meaningful relationship with another human being, because the only yardstick I had was, you know, mom and dad, and look at that relationship, that'll tell you, you know, about, and they say that if you're brought up in an alcoholic household, you pick up the traits of both the alcoholic and the co-alcoholic. So a lot of us become peacekeepers, too. We have a need to keep peace, you know. So I, for years, because I couldn't get in touch with my feelings, I didn't know anything about my feelings in sobriety. If I was with anybody who had feelings, I couldn't allow it. I couldn't allow it. If you started to express your feelings to me, I had to change them for you. I had to convince you that you weren't feeling what the hell you were feeling, that you were feeling what I wanted you to feel so that I could understand what it was you were feeling. See, because I didn't think it was okay to feel. I had a gal come up to me a couple of months ago. I loved it after it is. She was relating something to me. She's 9 years sober. She was engaged, and she's riding in the car with the guy that she's engaged to. And something made her really angry. Not having nothing to do with him. It was just some specific thing made her really angry.
And she got really mad and she started swearing and pounding her fist on the dashboard of the car. And you kind of care, son of a bitch, how could they do that? And tears, you know, just, oh, but honest to God, feelings come out, you know, just real feelings. Nobody's being hurt. And what's the word? Says, God, I'm ashamed of you. You know? I've always thought you were so level-headed. How could you possibly, you know, behave like this?
Sure, I know what I thought. Just that she'd get rid of him, but...
Because the last thing I need is somebody telling me I can't feel what I'm feeling. I need all the help I can to learn how to feel things. See, because I'm down inside of me, what I've discovered after, like I'm standing here now after about 5 years of therapy, I had to meet me. I had to get acquainted with me. I had to finally accept responsibility for my own life. Nobody else is going to do it. And when I began this process of digging back through this amnesia childhood of mine, I came across a guy who was great. I have his picture on my TV set at home, in the living room. And it's me. Okay? But I'm about a year and a half old. And I'm in a little sailor suit. And I've got the greatest, dumbest expression you've ever seen. Totally open, completely free, spontaneous, happy. Right? On the TV in a bedroom, I got another picture. I'm 12. And when I look at the picture sometimes, I start to cry. Because there's a 12-year-old boy, and his eyes are narrow, clear across his face with anger. And worse than the anger in the eyes, the horrible anger in his eyes, he's hopeless. I'm looking in the face of a 12-year-old child that feels no hope. 12 years old when he feels it's over. It's over at 12, right? If you think you undo that with 30 meetings of AA, yeah, maybe you can. I believe all this could be undone with one spiritual surrender. Okay, I just didn't happen to be able to achieve one at that depth. I also don't know anybody who has either, but it doesn't mean that it can't be. But when I began this process, I met this little 18. He's a beautiful child, but in order to meet him, I had to go through pain like I have never been through in my life. Because he was a mistreated, abused, ignored, unloved, destroyed child. And when I finally got in touch with him, I laid in that therapist's office and I cried until I hurt so bad inside it felt like somebody was beating me up from the inside out. Hundreds of hours of just pain and tears, right? Because this kid is sad. But if you think that that stuff ain't affected everything you do in your life today, you're nuts. As long as that unhappy kid is down there, he can screw it all. You know, and he has an attitude for guys or girls that goes either way about women. You know, based on number one, right? When he needed her the most, right? When dad was killing him, she'd go to the kitchen. So he knows you can't trust them. You know, it's like, he knows when he rolls over and turns his back. You ever meet somebody, or fall madly in love, you get together, you know, that first night, and it's really wonderful, and the sparks fly, and, you know, the two locomotives meet head on coming down the track, right? Everything's great and wonderful, but just before you go to sleep, that first night, there's a little child inside that says, uh-uh. No. She'll let you down like all the others. That's lethal. That stuff's lethal. That stuff wipes us out. And you girls, you know, you forget it. You know, you never got approval from dad, and we've been paying ever since. So it's a two-way street. You know, this is not a one-sided thing. Well, I meet this kid, and I get the pain out of the way, and I find out all he wants is a little bit of a love, and a little bit of my time, and a little bit of attention, and there's nobody else around to take care of him, so I'm going to take care of him. See? And the very first thing I learned about him, which most of you know or don't know, is that he loves teddy bears. You know, he absolutely loves teddy bears. Well, man, I went out and bought some teddy bears. You know, he's got bears now. He's got bears all over the house, and he loves his bears, right? And wherever I go, there's three bears in the hotel right now. They're resting. They're laying on the bed, and they have their hats down over their eyes, you know? But my child loves it, and I let him have the bears. I let him take the bears when we travel because he's contented as long as he has the bears with him. And I take it to extremes, but that's where he wants to take it. It's okay, like the Olympics, right? Okay, I'm home at the Olympics for 2 weeks, and the bears want to watch the Olympics. You know, right? My kid knew the bears wanted to watch the Olympics, so... There was a lot of time there when I left my apartment to go to a meeting or go to some place to do something or to go out all day long. If the managers of the building had come in, they would have thought I was Looney Tunes, right? Because both TV sets were on. The one in the bedroom and the one in the living room, and there was like 10 bears in the living room. Watching the Olympics, and there was 10 bears in the bedroom watching the Olympics. You know, a couple of them were Canadian bears, and that Canadian, you know, wearing the red wings. You know, I mean, well, I let my child do that today. You know, I mean, I could hear now the bitch over the goddamn electricity bill if I tried to do that when I was small. I don't care. Kid wants the bears to watch television. Terrific. You know, let him watch television and the Olympics. How many of you watched the Olympics? A few emotions there? Did you happen to get in touch with anything? Huh? I mean, I went through 13 boxes of Kleenex, for Christ's sake, still remember. You know, because I have a lot of feelings and emotions going on. You know, my child would see a child, a bigger child, on TV. And he'd hear, you know, the announcer would talk, and they would say, there's his mom and dad, right? They rode all the way from Minnesota on a motorcycle to be here for this kid's finest moment. And my child would die. He'd die. He'd cry so hard, because nobody'd walk 2 goddamn feet to be there for anything that he ever did. You know, forget Parents' Day at school. Scratch that one, you know. And it's like, but although he cried sad tears because he never had that, he also cried tears of joy because this other kid had it. Or when they talked about that one kid, his father worked overtime for 2 years, 5 nights a week. He put in 3 extra hours so this kid could participate in his sport and go to the Olympics. You know? And he was there waving a flag for his kid. God, I died. You know? Somebody loved him. Somebody cared about him. Somebody taught him he was important. I'm working extra for you because you're important. I want you to succeed, so I'm going to help you because you're important. I'm not asking you to change. I'm not asking you to be anything other than what you are. I'm not asking you to do anything other than what you do. I'm supporting you because you're important as you are. You wonder why we don't take care of ourselves? It's because we don't know that we're important. Nobody ever taught me I'm important. Nobody. I never had any conception of myself as being important. The only conception I ever had of myself is being in the way. Just in the way. If I wasn't there, everybody would be happier. So I learned to disappear, right? I learned to not be there. And Jesus, then my kid would see one of these kids on TV succeed and win the medal. Forget it. Or the wrestler that had cancer. Anybody see his interview after? I'm thanking the people who had helped him. People who made him feel important. That he mattered. Guys, we're worth taking care of here. You know, these travelers are right. These nutritionists are right. These people will look at us and say, there's something wrong with you if you haven't given up cigarettes, coffee, you know, sugar, meat, and taken up exercise. There's something goddamn wrong with you. Because you're worth that kind of care. Why aren't you doing it for yourself? You'll stay up all night to help the other son of a bitch quit smoking. You will go to greater lengths for him than you will yourself.
Hey, George, I sure hope it works.
I'll stay up with you all night so that you don't. That ain't how it works. You know, you could be George Moregood if you could stop yourself. But by example, if by example you can do these things, and you may not get it all right. And one of the things that will stop you cold every time you start any of it is if you give up any of these things, caffeine, sugar. I was at a discussion meeting, right? There's one guy at this discussion meeting. He's trying to talk about his feelings about his boss. And he had a pile of cookies in front of him like this and a big cup of coffee. And he was chain-smoking cigarettes. And after the meeting, I'm outside. And the two travelers, one of them took me aside. And he was so shy and so gentle. And he said, "I understand the need to express your feelings." He said, "I understand how terribly important it was for that man to talk about his feelings about his employer." And he looked at me, he said, "But how would he know what they are?" And he's taking in all that stuff. See, because you may not want to hear this, but all of that affects how you feel.
Sugar and weed, right? I mean, guys, the sugar industry loves us, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. We keep them going.
Oh, sugar, you. You need a lift during the day.
Yeah. With sugar for lunch, go back to the office, go to sleep on the desk. Yeah. No better than dope. You know, I don't want to deal with a relationship when you're home at night, eat an ice cream sundae, you know, just go to sleep on the couch, you know? Yeah. So we put all this crap in. I'm convinced, okay, the guys that founded AA, the first, well, let's...
Oh, geez, okay. I could talk about Eastridge and you, okay?
I'm convinced that that if the first 100 who founded AA today, I mean, 50 years ago, well, it's almost 50 years, 50 years next year, if they were to find AA today, therapy, exercise, and diet would be an integral part of the program because they were way ahead for their time. The reason I'm absolutely totally convinced of this now is among the first 100, there was a guy named Tom Powers, and he dropped out, and he said, "Wait a minute, guys, you're not taking it enough. You know, you're just not taking it far enough. You've stopped too soon." And we worry about the newcomer here. We tell people, you know, well, if you're emotionally upset, don't stop smoking. You know, don't give it all at once. It might be too much for you. You know, hey, come on. If you're kicking goddamn heroin, giving up cigarette smoking at the same time, it's going to go unnoticed, you know. So, he started his own place in the Catskill Mountains called Eastridge. Now, if you arrive there on their doorstep, a brand new addict alcoholic, say, "Hi, here I am for my first meeting." They don't want a lot from you, but they do want you to give up a few things. Day one. Day one, they'd like you to give up your drugs. You will give up. It's not really like. You will give up your drugs. You will give up your alcohol. You will give up sugar. You will give up caffeine. You will give up cigarettes. You will give up all processed foods. You will give up all meats of any kind. I can't think of what, and sex. For an indeterminate period of time. Time to determine later. How long, okay? And then you will go on through some intensive group therapy. You will arise early in the morning. You will pray. You will meditate. You will exercise. You will work hard. And you will eat a balanced diet of fruits and vegetables with a small amount of fish thrown in for lunch. Nutritionally balanced diet. Okay? That's day one. Nobody's saying, "Oh, gee, what about the feelings? What am I going to get upset? Oh, that's going to be really, rough." Yeah? And you know what the tragedy of that is? The tragedy, my lady went through the program, okay, and then went back to Canada after being through the program. Here's the tragedy around here, right? This is about 9.5, 10 years ago now. So she goes back, not smoking, not drinking coffee, not eating sugar, not eating meat, going, buying fresh vegetables at the store, you know, living on a healthy, totally healthy life, going meetings. But every time she'd express a feeling in AA,
I'm depressed. Damn, I'm so depressed today. I'm angry. At that guy. I'm angry. What kind of suggestions do you get here? What kind of help do you get? Do you get support for trying to have a really healthy, active, exercise, nutritionally balanced life? Nah. They say, why don't you have a cigarette? Take some of the spring out. Have a hamburger. Yeah, eat some red meat. Get rid of the pressure. You ask the support. She was able to last 8 months. I'm not told this. Yeah, I have to. Can't keep him in suspense. Just on one bad day, it all went. Sugar, meat, coffee, cigarettes, a man.
But although it's funny, and we can laugh at it, we laugh at it because underneath, inside of us somewhere, we know that's really very sad. It's very sad that when somebody can try and take care of themselves to the extreme, to the best job they can't get the support to do it. They can't get people to encourage them to take care of themselves. Not even, you know, we don't get it from ourselves because we don't know how. See, now, today I'm at the point. Today I'm at the point where I will say what was said to me a long time ago. If I have to view my parents, they did the best job they could with the information that they had. You know? In fact, I was watching a thing on TV the other night. It was really interesting. There was a little boy who walked up to his father and took his father's hand and he said, Dad, I love you. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, my little boy loved his dad too. And the only reason his father was unable to love him back is he was inflicted with a disease of alcoholism. It's the only reason he was unable to love him back. That's all. See, I can look at that now today and it's okay. But I could have looked at that 2 years ago and he died. I could have cried so hard I hurt, or I could have gone in and beat the sofa up till the springs didn't work anymore because of the rage. And I'm one of these people that's convinced until you get the rage out of the way, nothing's going to change. You know, nothing's going to happen. I mean, I have to give her my mother, but it's still impossible for me to spend time with her because she's not going to change. I leave my mother's house, God bless Lois, I leave my mother's house, I can't get 5 feet away, and I have to scream at the top of my lungs in the car, and I'm going to die. I'm going to die. You know, because it's like, so I have not, you know, so it's the best I know how to do. You know, today I still have forgiven her, but we have a communication problem. Hers hasn't changed in 74 years. You know, it's very difficult. So I think there's a time for forgiveness. And, you know, the problem for me is I can't be walking around mouthing this crap. If I haven't forgiven him, for me to walk around and pretend it is killing me. Killing me. I got to look at the fact that I didn't forgive him. I'm angry. I got really mad. I had to find out I was so angry over the treatment that that child got. I was scarred and rages. Rages. I used to beat the poor couch up in my therapist's office till my knuckles bled. But I got the anger out. I didn't have to beat my parents up with it. My mother doesn't even know what's going on, except she lost control. That's all she knows. She can't stand it. You know? Let me put it to you this way. Her husband was an alcoholic. Her son was a drug addict and alcoholic. And when I was, and she never went to an Al-Anon meeting in her life until I was 18 years sober. When I was 18 years sober, she finally went to an Al-Anon meeting. You know why? Because she was losing control. She thought going to Al-Anon would get control back. She stuck it out for 9 months. Didn't get control back. She hasn't been to an Al-Anon meeting in 3 years. Didn't work. See? The kid is on the loose. I wish I could wave a magic wand so that you would know that you're worth taking care of. Don't be afraid of the feelings. You know, we're like afraid of the feelings. Oh, by the way, if you're the adult child of an alcoholic, I would highly recommend therapy or ACA or both. Absolutely. You got to change the focus. You got to lose that idea that you're at fault, that I'm wrong. What's wrong with me? What did I do wrong? What's the matter with me? What's the matter with me? I've got to look and see what was done to me. I've got to find out why as an adult I can't function in society. I've got to find out why I'm looking to bosses who are 10 years younger than I am to be my parent. They don't work. It doesn't work out. You know?
I always put unreasonable demands on everybody in my life because I'm looking to them to fix something that they can't fix. I'm the only one who can take care of it. It was very well summed up once by somebody's mother. This is it. This is what it comes down to, in a way. A girl I know was having her first birthday, and her mother, who was 4 years sober, called her on her first birthday, and she said, "Look, the only thing I can give you on this, your number one birthday in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to tell you that I want you to know I am fully, absolutely aware that I am responsible for most of the problems that you have in your life today. I am responsible." She said, "But please, for your sake, understand you are responsible for the solutions to those problems." And that's what it's about. See, I didn't ask to turn out this way. I didn't ask to turn out afraid of my own shadow. I didn't ask to turn out unable to have a relationship. I didn't ask to turn out with no self-esteem. I didn't ask to turn out with a turned over foot. I didn't ask to turn out any of the way, any of the shit I got. I didn't ask for any of it. Didn't deserve any of it. I didn't do anything to deserve any of it. But I'm the only one today who can do anything about what's happened. No, but they can't fix it. You know, they ain't gonna fix it either. They don't want to fix it. They don't want it, can't, aren't gonna. I got it. I'm the one that's gotta go to work and begin the process to take care of this child and the adolescent. I've talked about the child and the adolescent. The adolescent and the child, it's like having a family when you get to know all these people that live inside of you. But the beauty is you get to know real people living inside of you with real feelings instead of the voices. Okay? The voices which are, you know how much fun they are, right? You know, wake up in the morning, nursery school. And you can teach them to live at peace. The adolescent and the child can get along. I'll tell this one story. I usually tell. Why not? What the hell? I got the adolescent. I got rid of a car a while back. I got a few years back. I got the adolescent a Corvette. I didn't want to get him one, but I felt he deserved it. You know, I didn't particularly like the car. I didn't want the car. I thought it looked silly in the car, and I think I was a little past the car. But I mean, he had a sales pitch going for the Corvette. It was not good enough. So I got him the Corvette. But the Corvette has T-ropes on it, right? You know, they come off. So now, all of you that have children, or remember children, or raising the children, you know, now I have the child I got to deal with too. Now, you know what a child is like in a car. A child is like a dog in a car, right? You know, they like to hang out the window. You know, right? So, I've got this car with a roof that comes off, and when I get ready to go take a long drive, the child wants the top off, right? You know, he wants to, you know, look around, cruise, and he wants the air and the wind, and children are spontaneous, right? They're like this, right? Well, the adolescent, see, he don't want the roof off, right? Because if the adolescent takes the roof off, the wind blows his hair. And he's the person who, you know, would look good dying, you know. I mean, they'd rather die than look bad, so I had to keep peace in the family. I had to buy a spray bottle, you know, of water and take the spray bottle of water and brush so that I could take the roof off for the child and fix the adolescent's hair when we got there. See? But it worked out. Also, guys, you'll be delighted to know it's the adolescent who's going, the one that's giving whiplash going down the street. I was so relieved to discover that he was the one that wanted to cruise the high school, you know. I used to think it was me and there was nobody I could talk to about it. What am I going to do, drive to Laguna and tell Chamberlain I'm, you know, I'm in love with the girls on the track at Beverly Hills High School, for Christ's sake? Yeah, Lesson also has no taste. If you guys ever notice that you'll fall in love with a leg, just a leg goes by. That's all he needs is a piece of leg. Oh, God, yeah!
So when you can finally put him in touch with the fact that he's in a 48-year-old body, you'll have more peace, you know? It takes a while to get him to accept that. Yeah, damn, you're just oh, what the hell. I'll share this one because this is really important. That's important to me. It may not be important to you. A year ago in November, I started running because I wanted to run a marathon. So I spent a year training to run a marathon. I ran from November to November, and I took off and went to Hawaii, and I was ready. By the time I left to go to Hawaii, I had run a 22-mile long run. I was feeling really good. I was looking forward to the marathon. I was very excited about having this accomplished. This. I felt great. Went to Hawaii 2 weeks early to get used to the humidity so I wouldn't get knocked out by the heat. I mean, I really took care of myself, and I prepared myself, and I did it right, and I did it slow. I didn't care if I looked good like a gazelle. I just wanted to finish like a 48-year-old man, right? So, 20-year-old world-class runner, you know, I just wanted to finish the race. I get to Hawaii, I get in the hotels, I go out and run the first day over Diamond Head, knock off an easy 13, the heat's not getting to me, I feel really good. And I do some lightweight upper body aerobics, so I go there, I can't find a gym with free weights, so I find a knotless gym, right? And I go to this knotless gym, and I can't remember anything about knotless equipment, and I don't know anything about knotless equipment. And I'm in a gym where half the staff, or more than half the staff, are these darling little girls with staff embroidered on their t-shirts right over their right breast, right? And I look at the machine, and I don't know how to use the machine. And I put a year in, right? Now, if I could have got a hold of the child or the adult, they would have asked. You know? The child will ask anybody anything because he doesn't care. Looking good is not important to him. How does that work? What does that do? What does that taste like? What's this thing on the menu? My kid's great with the menu. Well, how do they fix that? What is that? You know? Oh, yeah, great. You know, I don't think I'd like that. Bring me that instead. You know, the kid is great. You know, or the adult is practical. But the adolescent has got to look good. So I'm wearing my running shorts and my running shoes and a half marathon finisher shirt and, I could have asked somebody how the machine worked, but I walked the walk over to the machine, used it wrong, tore up the knee. So then I did everything I could for 10 days to put it back together, ran the marathon anyway, and I'm presently wrapped up from knee surgery. Finished. I have two pictures at home from the finish. You'll love this. When you first 100 yards or so from the finish, there's a big fake finish line, and you know they're taking your picture. There are little girls out there waving pom-poms and in dolphin shorts and smiling, and they're taking your picture. You know they're taking your picture. Now, my knee had gone out 18 miles in. I had to stop 20 miles in and get it wrapped like, you know, almost a cast, and I hop, skip, limp, drug it the next 8 miles to the finish line, right? Now, if you see the picture taken of me when I knew they were taking my picture, I look great. I look cool. I look comfortable. I look in amazing good condition for somebody who just finished running 26 miles. I look really good. But unfortunately, they also were taking pictures at the real finish line, and I didn't know that. I have these two pictures hung side by side, see? Because for those of you that identify with this, on the other one I look like I've just been hitting the kidneys with a nightstick. Because I was taken straight to emergency from the end of the race, right?
So one tells the truth and one doesn't.
Anyhow, the family is good, and when you could find out that you were taken care of, one little story and then I'll sit down and shut up. You're going to talk yourself out of everything for all kinds of reasons. But I love this story because it really sums it up for me anyway. I was watching an event on television one morning and they were interviewing this man. And the man they were interviewing was telling this story. He said, well, when he was 65, he was living with his son. He was retired. And his sons came to him one morning, and he said to him, now remember, 65 years old, because one thing we'll tell ourselves is it's too late. Alcoholics love to use that we've shot all of our wad, it's over. 65 years old, he said, his son came into his room and he said, Dad, I'm going to have to put you into a home. We can't have you here anymore. You're just sitting here, rotting away. And his dad said, and the guy said, I don't want to go in a home. That's the last thing in the world I want. I want to stay here with you. I do not want to be put in a home. And his son said to him, Dad, you got to do something. Do anything. You know, come run with me. Do something. So his dad said, okay, I'll do that. I'll do anything. I don't want to go in a home. So the next morning, his father got up. The old man got up with the kid and went to run. The old man was able to run for a quarter of a block, and that's it. He couldn't go one step further. He was ready to drop over at the end of the quarter of a block. So his son said, look, never mind, Dad. Forget it. So the next morning, the old guy got up and went out and ran a quarter of a block again. The next day, he got up and went out and ran another quarter of a block. The next day, he got up and ran, another quarter of a block. Then he got up and went out and ran a half a block. He got up and ran out and ran into a whole block after about 2 weeks. At the end of 3 months, he finally did a mile, 1 mile. And when he got to the end of that mile, he realized it's amazing how people who are alcoholics can hook things up. or I would almost like to say people who are not the adult children of alcoholics can hook things up. Because at the end of this mile, he said to himself, if I am in this terrible condition at this time in my life, then everything I have done must be wrong. Everything I'm doing must be wrong. I must change. I must change. So at that point, and at that time, at the end of the 3 months, after running a mile, he gave up everything. He gave up his cigarettes. He gave up his coffee. He gave up meat. He changed, gave up sugar. He changed his whole diet. And started reading books about God and about positive kind of thinking, okay? The morning this interview was being taken place, he was 83 years old, and he was there to run his 14th New York Marathon. Started out at 65, guys, but a quarter of a block, because he didn't want to be put in a home, you know. Think about that, because I don't want to be put in this goddamn home in sobriety of a little safe box, afraid to take care of me, you know? So if you leave here tonight and you're disturbed, I did what I was supposed to do. God bless you.